After that somewhat lengthy and quite entertaining introduction, we now come to the body of the sutta. The Buddha reflects for a long time now this spirit, that is, spirit word is yaka, and referring to Indra or Saka, has led a pure life. Any questions he asks me will be beneficial, not useless, and he will quickly understand any answer I give to his question. So he addressed Saka in verse, "Ask me your question, Vasava." So again, this being another name, we've heard Kosiya, Saka, Inda. "Ask me your question, Vasava. Whatever you want, I'll solve each and every problem you have." And notice at the end of that little verse, we have this little saying here. So this is not a part of the sutta as such, but this is a little kind of remark which is included in the manuscript. And it says the first Bahanavara, which I've translated as recitation section, is finished. So in the Pali texts, they are divided, as well as being divided semantically, right? So the Pali texts are divided semantically, by which I mean by sutta or by chapter or by some kind of meaningful grouping of the text. But they're also divided by recitation section, which is not really a semantic division of the text, or that might correspond to a semantic division of the text. But really what it means is this is a chunk of text which was considered suitable for one chanting session, right, or to be memorized in one go, right? So they would learn that kind of section, and they would learn that, and so that was like one recitation section. And so we find these remarks from time to time throughout the manuscripts. Okay, having been granted an opportunity, and as you can see here, it's not really a proper division in the text, it's just kind of stuck in there. Having been granted an opportunity by the Buddha, Saka then asked the first question. Okay. "Dear sir, what fetters bind the gods, humans, demons, dragons and fairies and any of the other diverse creatures so that though they wish to be free from enmity, violence, hostility and hate, still they have enmity, violence, hostility and hate?" Such was Saka's question to the Buddha, and the Buddha answered him, "Lord of gods, the fetters of jealousy and stinginess bind the gods, humans, demons, dragons, fairies, and any other diverse creatures, so that though they wish to be free of enmity, violence, and hate, they still have enmity, violence, hostility, and hate." So this was the first answer. Delighted, Saka approved and agreed with what the Buddha said, saying, "That's so true, blessed one, that's so true, holy one. Hearing the Buddha's answer, I've gone beyond doubt and got rid of indecision." Okay. So let's just pause for a moment there. So the question, we want to live without violence, right? Most of the time I think that's true, and yet we don't. There's got to be something behind that. Why is that? And it's still really a big problem, isn't it? Right? I mean, it's still something that really occupies, you know, a lot of our politics, a lot of our culture and these kinds of things. Why do we live in a world where there's so much hostility? I mean, it's crazy when you think about it. Why do we have all these armies for? What do we have all these guns for? It's crazy. What do people go around beating each other up for? It's really weird, isn't it? I don't know about you, but, you know, when I go about my life, I don't really kind of feel like beating people up a lot. On an average day, I mean, I sort of go about my life and, you know, people are, you know, usually okay, and you walk past them in the street and, you know, maybe you sort of nod and say hello, and most of the time, you know, people are pretty kind and polite. Occasionally they might be a bit annoying, right? But rarely do I really feel like sort of attacking someone and kicking them when they're down and beating them up. I mean, you know, certainly not like on a weekly basis. And I mean, Okay, we're kind of joking because I'm a monk and that, but even before I was a monk, you know, it wasn't for me, it was never part of my life or the way that I thought. I mean, it's one of the reasons I was attracted to Buddhism. But I know some people are like that, right? They think of getting into fights and, you know, Friday night would be a bit boring without getting into a bit of argy-bargy down the pub. So what's behind it, right? And of course, when answering this question, then different people will answer the question from different perspectives, right? And so some people will look at it, right, they'll look at it maybe politically, that there are you know, competing interests and political reasons, blah, blah, blah. And so the Buddha's answering from his perspective, which is from like a psychological and a spiritual perspective, and he's looking to, for in a fairly straightforward way, to say that from jealousy and stinginess. Okay, so some people have things that other people want, right? And other people don't want to, and you don't want to give them those things that you have. Yeah, and this is a very, very important point. And you know, you can see in the world today. A lot of conflict driven by inequality, right? Same thing, right? Why do people want things, right? And a lot of the things in the world which seems very strange, right? You know, why do billionaires try to earn even more money, right? Because the guy next to them's got an even bigger boat, right? That's why, yeah. But does anybody need to have that much money? The other day I read a proposal for the Beyoncé tax. Have you heard of that? The Beyoncé tax is based on the supposition that the wealth that people have, people say that they have this wealth because they are talented and hardworking. That's what people believe, right? The reason I have billions of dollars is because I deserve it, because I'm this good, right? I am blessed with this much talent and I've worked hard for it, therefore I deserve this money. So the idea behind the Beyoncé tax is that nobody can reasonably claim to be more talented or more hardworking than Beyoncé. Therefore, she has about $500 million, so that should be the maximum that any human being should have. And beyond that, you should have 100% wealth tax. And if you took that, you'd have trillions of dollars and you could solve climate change and all of the other things. I don't know, it seems like a fairly reasonable proposition to me. Right? But it's weird though, isn't it? Right? When you think about it, like why do people think that they deserve that much money? I mean, it's so strange. Yeah? I mean, I've met one gentleman who was worth maybe $10 billion. I don't know, he seemed like a nice fellow. $10 billion is a lot of money, though. What are you doing with $10 billion? Anyway. So then there's jealousy. Yeah? And it's interesting that the Buddha's like putting this here as like a kind of fundamental force leading to the divisions in society, right? Because then you have that jealousy, like what people want and what they see. You know, people's desire tends to be triggered by what they see, like somebody else wants, right? So we don't kind of innately want all these things, but it's triangulated. There's a French philosopher, René Girard, who talks about this a lot. I don't know if I agree with everything that Girard was saying, but he certainly was onto something where he's talking about this idea that we want because somebody else wants. And, you know, this is how advertising works, right? So you put, you know, a beautiful, attractive person there. They want this thing, therefore I want it too. And it triggers something very primal in your brain to actually activate you to create that desire for things. And this is kind of one of the, I guess, one of the deceits of our society that we, you know, if you look at the fundamentals of economic theory, is based on the idea that essentially that human desire is unlimited. Right? This is one of the basic assumptions. It's not really true, actually, right? Because if human desire was really unlimited, why would they be spending so much money to create desire, right? Which is what the advertising industry is for. Yeah? Why would we be creating so much desire? Yeah? Actually, human desire, you know, there's plenty of people who live in the world who are quite content. And it's actually not that uncommon, right? I mean, I meet lots of people, just not necessarily monks or something, but just like ordinary people who maybe live quite a simple life, have a, you know, a house and they're quite okay. They're like, no, I'm not really ambitious. I'm not going to, you know, go and earn, you know, I'm quite happy with my job and, you know. So there are people like that. It's not that uncommon. But then when we see things, we want them and we want to have them. One of the stories I heard years ago, when I visited the Aboriginal community at the Mumpa, and when you go into that community, my friend Thisbe was living there, working there at the time, and when you're in the middle of Central Australia, and then you go into the community, there's these kind of rows of sort of white brick and tile houses. They look completely out of place, right? And they especially look out of place because they're all burnt, or half of them are burnt. So I asked my friend Thisbe, like, what's going on with these houses? She said, well, look, the community here, they got a grant from the government, right, to build housing. And, you know, the people came from the government and said, what kind of housing do you want? And they said, we want houses just like the ones on Neighbours. Because they all watch Neighbours every night. Even though they can't speak English in that community, but they still watch Neighbours and they love the houses. They're, oh, I wish we could have a house like that, because you see it. And then the people from the government are saying, okay, but, you know, it's probably not a very suitable dwelling for this environment. You know, maybe we could do something like this or like this, and no, we want houses just like the ones on Neighbours. So that's what they did. They came and they built houses just like the ones on Neighbours, which is great. Except the problem is that they're not acculturated to living in those houses, like, at all. And when the winter comes, the cold winter nights, they'll pull the front door off and burn it in the lounge room. If somebody, like, traditionally, if somebody dies in the humpy, then they'll put their body there and they'll burn it. So that's what they do. If someone dies in one of the houses, they just burn the house down. Yeah? And so we forget these things. We forget that we have actually learned, we've been acculturated to learn how to live in houses. I mean, it seems obvious to us, right? I mean, just as it seems obvious to Aboriginal people that if you're walking across the desert, if you want a meal of goanna, you pick up the stick and you throw it at the goanna and you hit it and then you cook it, and that's obvious to them. They can survive in the desert in a place we couldn't, but they have a different skills than we do. And so the skills function in their environment, but then when you have that impact, which we don't really consider, like, nobody really thought about this, right? When we decided to have television, right? We can have these shows and we can broadcast them all around the world and anyone can watch them, but no one actually thinks about what's going to happen. Nobody thought, what's the consequence of the internet? Right? We just did it. Nobody thought, oh, what's the consequence of YouTube? We just did it. And the speed of these things happens faster and faster and faster, and we haven't learnt to cope with that. Another story I learned about the Aboriginal communities when I was at uni, I read anthropology. I wasn't enrolled in the anthropology course. It would be ridiculous. I wasn't reading about the things that I was actually enrolled in, but I was wasting my time in the library just browsing in the stacks and reading random things that I came across. And one of them was a very moving story about a particular Aboriginal tribe in Queensland. And when the missionaries came, one of the missionaries gave them a steel axe. All right, and so this is a otherwise completely, you know, untouched tribe, no modernization or anything like that, and they're just given one steel axe. And the missionary just wasn't anything bad. He just saw that it was hard for them to chop firewood, right? And thought, oh, it'd be a lot easier for them if they had an axe to chop the firewood. So he introduced that. Right? Oh, great! So the guy with the axe chops the firewood, makes a fire, terrific. But then somebody else sees him. Oh. Okay, I want that axe. Well, no, you can't have it. Right? And that's where jealousy leads to enmity, violence, hostility, and hate. Because they had not developed, like, notions of private property in the way that we have. They'd never had a possession that one of them had that others didn't have. everything that they'd used before, they just found in nature. They maybe had they learned the skills to be able to make the tools and so on. So they had the skills to do all of those things, but they didn't have, like, you know, individual property, and everybody wanted this axe because it was so valuable. And eventually, that tribe just completely broke up. It's disappeared now. It doesn't exist because of that one axe. That's what's happening here, that jealousness and stinginess leading to hostility and breakdown of societies. And it's very hard for us to understand how much we have been acculturated and conditioned to cope with all of these things, right? To cope with difference and inequality and ownership. And, you know, think of all the complex laws and things like that we have to do that, and copyright laws and all of these property laws and all of those things, and this whole complex to be able to handle this, and it breaks down still all the time. But this is what we're doing with our modern technologies. We're doing this vast, uncontrolled experiment, right, across the world, and just kind of hoping that human nature isn't human nature anymore, I guess. We'll see how that works out. So this is that meaning of that first one, the fetters of jealousiness and stinginess lead to enmity, violence, hostility, and hate. Any thoughts or questions about that? Okay, so then Saka keeps on asking, okay? Go underneath that. What's the origin, the source, origin, birthplace, and inception of jealousy and stinginess? When what exists, is there jealousy and stinginess? When what doesn't exist, is there no jealousy and stinginess? And I'm sure many of you are probably familiar with the idiom of the suttas, but just in case you know you're not, or just to mention, I mean, we see this quite verbose and repetitive style of sentence here, and the purpose of this style, I mean, partly it's literary for emphasis. Actually, you could just ask, what's the cause of jealousy? Right? It means the same thing. But it's the repetition is there to preserve the information. That's the primary reason for keeping the repetition there. Because if you lose a word, you lose a phrase, you even lose a whole sentence, it still doesn't change the meaning of the text. Okay? So it's all backups. So you're seeing the suttas again and again, backups, everything's backed up. Words are backed up, sentences are backed up, phrases are backed up, paragraphs are backed up. So if somebody forgets or misremembers a particular passage, it's always found somewhere else, and you can always check it and restore it. Yeah. So this is information preservation. This is why you get that sometimes verbose phrasing. So what is the cause of jealousy and stinginess? The liked and the disliked. Right. So we have preferences. Ah, I want this, I don't want that. Yeah, and I think it's hilarious sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes if you're like walking through a shopping center or walking through, you know, an airport or something like that, and you see all of these luxury goods and things like that, and you think, people who make these luxury goods must just laugh at how stupid rich people are. Like, I mean, serious. I mean, they're paying such ridiculous amounts of money for clothes and perfumes and handbags and all of this kind of bling, which is basically the same as what you can get in the market for, like, you know, a tenth of the price. I mean, they must sit around and dream up, like, how can we make something that's just, like, so completely ridiculously stupid to see how stupid rich people really are? And then they'd be like, oh, yeah, actually, no, they still go off and buy it, yeah. The liked and the disliked. Yeah. And actually, the things that matter in life, material things, not that much, you know? And if you don't have too much preferences, you know, enough clothes to wear, a decent place to stay, it's clean and a bit of space, yeah, enough food to eat, some clean water, that's not too much really. And if we were all content with that, I think life would be a lot better. Anyway, okay, so preferences, the liked and the disliked. So what's the source of what's liked and disliked? Desire, chanda. Source of the liked and disliked. What's the source of desire? Thought. Interesting, right? So now this is getting into quite interesting psychology. Desire is originated from thought, right? And then what's the source of thought? And this is the most difficult line or passage in the sutta, concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions are the source of thoughts. Okay, concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions. Okay, and I'll just show the Pali for that, because it's an interesting and difficult line in Pali as well as in no, not tanha. So thought is the source of desire, chanda, desire. Vitaka is the thought of chanda. What's the thought of vitaka, chanda? Concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions. Okay, so the Pali here is papancha sanya sankhara. Okay, so this is a quite a complex thing. Here's a breakup of it. So notice how on sort of central we can reveal the Pali source for each phrase. And so you can see the Pali together, and you can activate the Pali lookup and actually see the breakup of the Pali compound there. So that's pretty cool, right? How do we do that? How do you do that? You get very clever people to figure out how to do it for you. Yeah. So it doesn't get it 100%, right? Pali is a bit difficult to do like that, but in this case it works pretty well. So the first, there's a compound, and the Pali compound is, the first term is papancha, which here it says an obstacle, impediment, delay, illusion, hindrance to spiritual progress. More commonly these days it's translated as proliferation. Okay. Sanya, sense or perception, mark, name, recognition, gesture, in this case perception. Sankhara is an enumeration or calculation, a number, a definition, but also a concept, a reckoning. And nidana is a source, cause or origin. This particular compound is extremely difficult to pass and to define, and you'll find that different translators will translate it in quite different ways. So there's each individual element of the compound has a number of different renderings and can be interpreted in different ways, but also the relationship between the elements of the compound is a bit difficult to figure out. Similar compounds occur in a number of different places in the canon, so we can sort of, you know, compare from one to the other. And so this is what I think that it means. You know, the concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions. Okay, so the idea here is that this is the source of thoughts. So the idea here is that when we have perceptions, right? So we have ideas about things. You perceive that man and woman. You perceive light and dark. You perceive odd and even, liked and disliked, and so on. And these perceptions tend to kind of proliferate and spin out in your mind, and you create a sense of self. And so we tend to create a sense of self, a sense of who we are, among our perceptions. So think about things like, say, football teams. It's just an obvious example, right? So, you know, I like this football team, right? If you're wearing my colours, you're my mate, yeah? You're wearing the wrong colours, so we get this dividing and perceiving people, forming groups and so on based on preferences, and we form our sense of self. It might not be a football team, it might be a profession. Right, it might be being a fan of a particular comic book superhero, right? And it might be whatever it is. What's another example? The kinds of things, wearing a particular kind of clothes, having a particular kind of smartphone, right? All of these kinds of things we use to define ourselves, right? Maybe coming from a particular culture, right? I'm Australian, right? G'day, mate. So I identify with that, right? And so it's natural to have those kind of senses of identity and so on. But then they tend to proliferate and they tend to get overdetermined. And so the idea here between the concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions. Yeah. Yeah. Sankhara, yeah. No. Sanya is. Sankhara is what you're thinking of. Actually, a different word. Yeah. Yep. Right. Right. That's correct. Yeah, that's right. Normally, you know, it's, again, they're closely related ideas. But yeah, so here, I think this is a bit more preliminary. Like the sankhara is more like the choices and volitions you make based on that, right? Whereas this is more about the perceptual process, about the formation of our identity through our perceptual process. Yeah, so it's a bit more basic, a bit more preliminary. This is one of the points. I mean, yes, they can be described as co-arising, but you can also sort of tease them out in a kind of linear sense. Yeah. But yeah, the word sankhara, you know, as it says here, often means like literally an enumeration or like an accountant would be called someone who does sankhara, right? Does counting and so on. Yeah. I often translate it as reckoning. It has that idea of kind of judgment and evaluation. Papancha is one of the most difficult words in Pali to understand properly. And one of the most famous books by Venerable Nyanananda, the old Nyanananda, not the younger Nyanananda, called Concept and Reality, was published in the early 70s, and that discusses that concept in quite some detail. One of the classics of modern Buddhist studies. Okay. Right. Right, so the end part is just different synonyms for to be born or sourced. Right? Yep. So it's the same in the other ones. You can see King Nidana, King Samudaya, King Jataka, King Pababo. So these are just synonyms to be sourced or born from something. So I've abbreviated a lot of that away in the translation. Okay. And for more about that idea is in the Madhupindika Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which talks about the Papanchasanya Sankhara in more detail. So, Saka goes on, how does a mendicant fittingly practice for the cessation of concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions? All right, so what's the right kind of practice to do that's going to lead to the ending of this? Right, so the concepts of identity, holding on to a sense of self, right, that come from this proliferation of perceptions. This is what's the source of all of these things. It's leading to violence and hostility, leading to people fighting against each other. And one thing I forgot to mention, of course, just to come back to look at the narrative flow of it. I should have mentioned this earlier. Come back to look at the narrative flow. So we have here Saka coming on to... Anyway, so a bit earlier, we mentioned that Saka had said, oh, it's good that the Buddha's here now because the gods are getting greater and the demons are getting less, right? The implication they're now going to win their war, right? So now he's asking, well, why are we fighting, right? What's this enmity? And so it's not the fact that Saka asking this question, right? This is subtext, right? It's not spelled out in the sutta itself, but he was originally the god of war. Right? And so he's starting to question, why are we fighting each other? Right? What's going on? And if you look at in the Sakka Sanyutta, it's very interesting because it has a number of the suttas that talk about this tussle between the devas and the asuras, or the gods and the titans, or the gods and the demons. And leader of the asuras, or the leader of the demons, whose name is... What's his name again? It escapes me at the moment. But he and Saka have a bit of a bromance going, right? And they're kind of you know, on the one hand they're fighting with each other and stuff like that, but on the other hand they kind of also can't sort of leave each other alone, right? And they're kind of always getting into these different situations, and one of them will capture the other and the other will capture the one, and they're kind of back and forth. And, you know, so it's almost like if you think about stories, think about the way that these stories are being told, right? So you can think about the story as, oh yes, there was one enemy and it's fighting the other enemy and they came together and they fought. Okay, that's fine. You tell that story. Right? Sometime later you tell that story again. And a bit later you tell that story again. And you tell it again and again and again. And your children tell the story and your grandchildren. And 10 generations later they're still telling that story, right? And as you tell that story again and again and again, the characters become familiar to you. And the characters become familiar to each other because they're constantly reappearing in that story, right? I mean, it's like the Buddha and Devadatta, yeah? I mean, on the one hand, they're kind of enemies, but on the other hand, well, they're kind of best mates. They can't sort of leave each other apart, yeah? And so they're this kind of strange respect and familiarity and friendship is sort of grows up in that relationship. And then you can see why then Sakka's like, you know, just again leaving aside questions of even Buddhism or Hinduism or Brahmanism or even mythology and those kinds of things, but just in terms of like the connection between people, you can see that after a while you're in that enmity and you begin to ask yourself, why? What were we fighting about in the first place? Yeah. So this is where the roots of this question come. Okay. Now, another couple of interesting details. So Sakka's now asking, how do we get rid of the sense of identity? Right? We have this next section. Now notice that in this next section it's titled Meditation on Feelings. Right? The Pali it says Vedana Kamatana, right? The word Vedana is feelings, Kamatana is meditation, right? Many people be familiar with that word, Kamatana. Of course, the word Kamatana is not found in the suttas at all in the sense of meditation, right? It's strictly a later word from the Visuddhimagga, 1,000 years after the Buddha. And yet here it is in the Pali text, in the title. Pali manuscripts don't have titles at all. So this title has been inserted by an editor at some point, and the editor has used later language to describe this. Right? Worth noticing this, because if we don't realize it, then we tend to sort of think, oh, this is what is actually the sutta is actually saying. No, this isn't what the sutta is saying. This is what an editor 1,000 years later, or maybe 2,000 years later, has said. Right? It is hard, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we want to look at the sort of the evolution of the manuscripts and see how these things were put in. But it's also one of the reasons why on Sutta Central, all of the headings on Sutta Central are in a grey font. Right? So the text is in black, the headings in grey, and that's why. Yeah. So you can assume that normally all the headings are added later. Okay. Lord of Gods. So again, why? How do you get rid of these perceptions of proliferation? Lord of Gods, there are two kinds of happiness, they say. That which you should cultivate and that which you should not cultivate. Two kinds of sadness, that which you should cultivate and that which you should not cultivate. Two kinds of equanimity, that which you should cultivate and that which you should not cultivate. Why are there two kinds of happiness? Take a happiness of which you know. So the word for happiness here is somanasa. When I cultivate this kind of happiness, unskillful qualities grow and skillful qualities decline. You should not cultivate that kind of happiness. Take a happiness of which you know, when I cultivate this kind of happiness, unskillful qualities decline and skillful qualities grow. You should cultivate that kind of happiness. Right? So, worth bearing this in mind in the context, like these days we often think of Buddhism and, you know, it's a wellness therapy and mindfulness and happiness and all of these kinds of things. And the Buddha was analytical. Happiness is good, but the happiness that comes from something which is wholesome is what really matters. And that which is free of placing the mind and keeping it connected is better than that which still involves placing the mind and keeping it connected. So this is a bit of a technical term, and it's difficult to translate it in a sort of elegant way in English, but essentially what it means is the happiness of jhana. Okay, this is what it's talking about here. So the happiness of the higher jhanas, which are free of vitaka and vichara, are better than the happiness of the lower jhanas. Okay, so the Buddha is saying, first of all, we distinguish between wholesome happiness and unwholesome happiness, but then even among wholesome happiness, the happiness of deep meditation is better still. So this is what's been said here. Why are there two kinds of sadness? When I cultivate this kind of sadness, unskillful qualities grow, skillful qualities decline. You should not cultivate it. Take a sadness of which you know, when I cultivate this kind of sadness, unskillful qualities decline and skillful qualities grow. You should cultivate that kind of sadness. And that which is free of placing the mind and keeping it connected is better than that which still involves placing the mind and keeping it connected. That's why I said there's two kinds of sadness. That's a bit weird, isn't it? How can you be practicing jhanas with sadness? I'm doing my sad jhanas now. It's a bit weird, isn't it? Maybe this is the answer. See. Does anyone have any thoughts about that? Yeah, in the suttas, if it says savitakang savicharang, it's always referring to first jhana, yeah. Well, like normally always. But then you'd have to ask, is that really the case here? Right. Yeah. I think it's a difficult passage. I'm not entirely sure exactly what it means there. Elsewhere, when the Buddha talks about dominasa, and he talks about the what is called niramisa dominasa, and spiritual sadness. And the spiritual sadness is where you have a longing for the higher attainments that you have not yet reached. Yeah, and you think, oh, I've been sitting meditating for so long, I haven't got anywhere. Right? Then that's a kind of spiritual sadness. So that, you know, you can see how that might be kind of a wholesome thing, right? Because it's like prompting you to practice. But what exactly is meant here? I'm not entirely sure, I have to admit. Yeah. Maybe. It could be. I mean, I wonder whether it's just an artifact of a overly sort of sometimes the texts get repeated in an artificial nature. And so sometimes you can just get weird artifacts because it sort of gets copied from the A to B and then it gets flipped over. And so sometimes you can overinterpret things and it actually is just an accident of the manuscript. But I honestly, in this particular case, I'm not really sure. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Right. Maybe, yeah. Because there is something like, there is something about, in compassion, there is something that's a bit sad in there, isn't there? Yeah? Can we have to connect with that sadness in people? Maybe. Okay. So then there are two kinds of equanimity. Again, some kinds of equanimity, unskillful qualities grow, skillful qualities decline, don't cultivate it, but if unskillful qualities decline and skillful qualities grow, you should cultivate it, and that which is free of placing the mind and keeping connected, that is to say, in the higher jhanas, is better than that which still involves placing the mind and keeping it connected. What? What are the What do you mean specific? Can you be more specific?
I don't know. I've said it so big, but I'm trying to figure it out.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Yeah. Well, fair enough. Yeah.
So, what is it?
Right. So one part is that that's leaving it open for your investigation, right? So you can say, well, look, if I have this experience of pleasure, and then you look, actually, does this lead to happiness or not? Yeah? And of course, that can be contextual, right? So you might say, well, look, eating chocolate cake, does that lead to happiness? Well, it depends. I mean, if you're sitting by yourself alone and gorging on a whole chocolate cake while binging on Netflix at night, maybe not, right? But if you're sharing it with your grandchildren and family and bringing everyone together, then maybe it is, you know? So, you know, it depends on context. So, you know, I think that there are other places where it talks in more detail, right? So usually with the suttas, what you find is that there's like you say, you know, it is vague and it doesn't explain itself here, but usually it'll be explained somewhere else, you know? But it's also, it's leaving it to your investigation. Yeah? Right? Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, generally speaking, we've got an idea of what that might mean, right? So, you know, the kinds of equanimity that lead to happiness and don't lead to happiness, right? That lead to increasing of wholesome and decreasing of unwholesome. So some kinds of equanimity we have is like an indifference, like a not caring, right? And then that can become quite unskillful because you can get alienated, you can get cut off from people, and you can become kind of emotionally isolated. And so then that's not very kind of nurturing. But then there can be another kind of equanimity that actually is impartial and non-discriminatory, right? Non-judgmental. And then that can lead to, you know, to what is wholesome. Yeah? Okay. Right, yes. Right, yeah. That's right, yeah. So, I mean, which is one of the reasons why, you know, equanimity always comes through metta. Right? Do metta first. If you don't do metta first, then it's likely your equanimity is a bit... Yes, nothing to do with me. Leave me alone. Yeah. Okay. So that's how a mendicant fittingly practices for. This is a typo there. Fittingly, I have. Oh my goodness, I have to fix that. Practices for the cessation of concepts of identity that emerge from the proliferation of perceptions. Okay, so then Saka asks another question. So this one not directly connected. Seems like going on to another topic. Not quite sure why he's introducing another topic here, but anyway, how does a mendicant practice for restraint in the monastic code, right? Kataṃ patipanno pana marisa bhikkhu patimokkha saṅgharāya patipanno hoti. So, why is the Sakha asking this? Not exactly sure. But anyway, he does. The Buddha answers in a similar way. Bodily behavior you should cultivate, verbal behavior you should cultivate. And you shouldn't cultivate two kinds of search, that which you should cultivate and that which you should not cultivate. And similarly, in each case, that sometimes it will lead to kusala dhammas, wholesome dhammas, skillful dhammas increasing or skillful qualities declining. So thus you should cultivate it or not cultivate it. The idea of a search here here primarily refers to the idea of a search in the Buddhist text is quite an interesting one, but what it refers to is a search for an answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything. Right? This is actually what it means, right? The quest for a holy life, the quest to find a teacher who can answer your questions. Right? The most famous search is the Arya Paryasana, which is the noble quest which the Buddha or Bodhisattva did after he left home, looking for an answer, and went around to the different teachers, trying out different practices, trying to see what's going to lead to enlightenment and what's not going to lead to enlightenment. So that's that kind of search. So there's some kinds of search which you should cultivate and some which you should not cultivate. Can you give me what do you think? What kinds of search should you not cultivate? Sorry? Google searches? You think that's what he meant? Maybe. Right? Yeah. Right? So kind of search like the kind of search which I think the Buddha was referring to here would be, you know, if we think it within the context of Siddhartha's own life, when he left the palace, he was making a search for what leads to the ending of birth, aging, and death, right? And it gets out of suffering, and that's the Arya Paryasana, that's the noble quest. So some kind of quest for some spiritual thing that's actually not leading to that, which might be a quest, for example, for psychic powers, right? And a quest to unseat Saka from his throne as the king of the gods, right? Or a quest to, perhaps even a quest to win the hand of the divine maiden who you're interested in, right? Which Panchasika was doing at the beginning, yeah? And so these perhaps are the kinds of quests which a monk should not be engaging in. No. Okay. I won't go through all that in detail, but the same pattern applies through those things. Then Saka goes on. The next question, how does the mendicant practice for restraint of the sense faculties? So again, two kinds of sight known by the eye, that which you should cultivate and that which you should not cultivate, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and thoughts known by the mind. So those things which lead to unskillful and skillful and so on as before. And Saka goes on to ask, dear sir, do all ascetics and Brahmins have the same doctrine, ethics, desires, and attachments? Now, just briefly, this phrase that's used here is a stock phrase, ascetics and Brahmins. So, in one respect, this refers to the two movements of spiritual and philosophical practitioners in the time of the Buddha. The Brahmins, of course, were the inheritors of the Vedic tradition, the hereditary Brahmanical caste, and which was quite diverse at the time of the Buddha. The ascetics were the rebels, if you like, who rejected the Brahmanical orthodoxy and proposed usually a technique of finding out the truth by themselves. And the Buddha always identified himself as being one of the ascetics, one of the samanas. Okay? But the ascetics and Brahmins as a overall compound like that generally just means spiritual seekers. Right? So it's used in a generic sense of being people, spiritual seekers, spiritual teachers and so on. And interestingly enough, Patanjali in his grammar gives an example, samana brahmana, of a compound between two things that are perpetually at war with one another. Okay, so like in English you might say cats and dogs. Yeah, so samanas and brahmins are always arguing with each other. So do all ascetics and brahmins have the same doctrine, ethics, desires and attachments? Ekanta vada, ekanta sila, ekanta chanda, ekanta jhosana. No, Lord of Gods, they do not. Maybe that's a mistranslation. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go back and revise that. I think that might be a mistaken translation. The word ekanta here literally means one end, which would be translated as do the doctrines, ethics, desires, and attachments of all the ascetics and Brahmins have the same end, the same goal. I'm going to have to go back and revisit that. I might have mistranslated it, ekanta. Anyway, no, they don't. The world has many and diverse elements. Whatever element sentient beings insist on in this world of many and diverse elements, they obstinately stick to it, insisting that this is the only truth. Other ideas are silly. Okay? Itameva sacham moghamanyam. But this phrase here is a little bit tricky to translate into English. The word mogha is related to moha, meaning delusion, right? Other ideas are delusional, they're misleading and so on. Right, so this is the only truth. Other ideas are silly. It's like a kind of dismissive statement. So it's like saying, I've got the answer. Everything else is ridiculous. Right? It's just silly. And the reason I translate it as silly is because it's a bit more dismissive than saying merely that it's incorrect. Right? Not saying this guy. Yeah, it's a bit more, you know, this is it, oh, that's ridiculous, you know. It's dismissive and patronizing rather than simply saying this is true and that's false. Sorry? This is mogam anyang. Yeah, so that's breaking it up incorrectly, but it's moga. The M there is just a sandhi. So it's actually, the word is moga, meaning delusional or empty, vain, useless, and then anya, meaning other. Okay, so not everybody has the same doctrine. Why? Because the world itself is diverse. It's an interesting point that the Buddha is making here, and an important philosophical and spiritual point. And we often hear that today. All teachings are the same, all religions are the same, and so on. The Buddha is saying, no, actually the world is diverse, right? And people pick up and attach to different aspects of things in the world, and they come up with different ideas regarding that. And it's an interesting perspective because it comes back to this idea that to say that doesn't mean that they're all completely wrong, right? And, you know, you think of similes like the elephant, right? The blind man and the elephant, right? They're all sort of, you know, touching and describing a different part of the elephant. They maybe have something right, but they haven't got the whole picture. Yeah? So the world actually is diverse. So the Buddha doesn't support the idea that all religions are the same, okay? But that's not to say that all religions are completely different, right? So we get attached to the differences, and that's why we have that difference. So have all ascetics and Brahmins reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal? No, Lord of Gods, they have not. Why not? Those mendicants who are freed through the ending of craving have reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal. These are all, of course, terms for nirvana. But those, of course, who are not freed through the ending of craving have not reached that. Okay? So, term here, through the ending of craving, tanha sankhaya vimutta, is a term that's used in another discourse with Sakka. So interesting that the same term is used in two discourses to Sakka, the complete destruction of craving. Then he asked another question. Passion, sir, eja, is a disease, an abscess, a dart. Passion drags a person to be reborn in life after life. Eja rogo, eja gando, eja salang, eja imang purisang parigaddhati. Tasa taseva bhavasa abhinibhatiya. Right, so it drags a person. Eja drags you. Parikadati, that's a strong word. It's used like when you're arrested and someone's grabbing you by the arms and dragging you off. Yeah? So craving is like that. It's like we've been dragged off by force. That's why a person finds themselves in states high and low. elsewhere among other ascetics and Brahmins, I wasn't even given a chance to ask these questions that the Buddha has answered. And this is one of the things which is actually said a number of times about the Buddha, that people say, oh, they could actually ask these questions. Notice how, you know, Sakya was quite nervous about coming to see the Buddha. Maybe this was why he was nervous, right? Maybe he had had bad experiences before. And in, say, a place like Samanyapala Sutta, King Ajatasattu says the same thing, that he'd asked these questions and never really received satisfactory answers. And I think this is, you know, to me, this is one of those kind of little points about the Buddha's personality, which I think is easy to overlook, but it's really worth bearing in mind. The Buddha was the kind of teacher who you could actually approach, sing a love song if you like, you don't have to, and ask your questions and get an actual answer to them. The dart of doubt and uncertainty has laid within me for a long time, but the Buddha has plucked it out. Dancha Bhagavata Aburhang. And so again, this is a suggestion, doesn't say explicitly, the suggestion that he's become a stream enterer, he's overcome doubt. Lord of Gods, do you recall having asked this question of other ascetics and Brahmins? I do, sir. Tell me how they answered. Sir, I approached those who I imagined were ascetics and Brahmins living in the wilderness in remote lodgings, but they could not answer. They even questioned me in return. Ko namo ayasma? What is the Venerable's name? So I answered them, dear sir, I am Sakya, Lord of Gods. So they asked me another question, but Lord of Gods, what deed brought you to this position? What karma made you become the Lord of Gods? And they taught him the Dhamma as I had learned and memorized it, and they were pleased with just that much. We have seen Sakya, Lord of Gods, and he answered our questions. Invariably, they became my disciples. I don't become theirs. But, sir, I am the Buddha's disciple, a stream enterer not liable to be reborn in the underworld bound for awakening. And so here we find that he is explicitly declaring that he's a stream enterer, a sovan or sotapanna. Lord of Gods, do you recall ever feeling such joy and happiness before? I do, sir, but how? Once upon a time, sir, a battle was fought between the gods and the demons. Ah, here we go. Right. War stories. In that battle, the gods won and the demons lost. It occurred to me as a victor. Now the gods shall enjoy both the nectar of the gods and the nectar of the demons. Diba Oja. Asura Oja. But, sir, that joy and happiness is in the sphere of the rod and the sword. It doesn't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. But the joy and happiness I feel listening to the Buddha's teaching is not in the sphere of the rod and the sword. It does lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. But Lord of Gods, what reason do you see for speaking of such joy and happiness? I see six reasons to speak of such joy and happiness, sir. While staying right here, remaining in the godly form, I have gained an extended life. I know this, dear sir. So this is now the first reason that he speaks of this happiness, right? So his lifespan as a god has been extended because of his understanding or attainment of the Dhamma. When he falls from the heavenly host, leaving behind the non-human life, I shall consciously go to a new womb wherever my mind delights. Okay? Again, interesting. These are not things that are actually mentioned very often in the suttas. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to think of another place that mentions this. But anyway, it's an interesting detail. So he's saying that as a god and a stream enterer, he can get, when it comes time to be reborn, he's not fully enlightened yet, but he can consciously decide where he wants to be reborn. Interesting, right? So living happily under the guidance of the one of unclouded wisdom, I shall practice according to method, aware and mindful. This is the third reason, right? So he's continuing to practice. Again, that point that was raised earlier about whether those in the deva realms and so on can practice the Dhamma. Well, here he's saying that he will continue to practice according to method. Method, of course, being the Noble Eightfold Path. And if awakening should arise as I'm practicing according to the method, I shall live as one who understands, and my end shall come right there. Okay, if it becomes an arahant. When I fall from the human realm, leaving behind the human life, I shall become a god again in the supreme heaven realm. Deva lokam hi uttamo. The fifth reason, sixth reason, they are the finest of gods, the glorious Akanetas. So long as my final life goes on, there my home will be. So the Akanetas are the realm, one of the realms of the pure abodes, where the non-returners are living. So he's saying that at least if he doesn't become an arahant in this life or the next life, then at least he will get reborn in the realm of the non-returners, the pure abodes. Right. Yeah. So it's not an idea that you find in the suttas a lot, but the Bodhisattva is said to sort of be reborn mindful. So it is found, but it's not emphasized a lot. And Saka went on to say, my wish is unfulfilled. Doubting and undecided, I wandered for such a long time in search of the realized one. I imagined that ascetics living in seclusion must surely be awakened, so I went to sit near them. How is their success? How is their failure? But they couldn't answer such questions about the path and practice. And when they found out that I was Sakka, come from the gods, they questioned me instead about the deed that brought me to this state. I taught them the Dhamma as I'd learned it among men. They were delighted with that, saying, we've seen Vasava. Now, since I've seen the Buddha who helps us overcome doubt today, free of fear, I pay homage to the Awakened One. Destroyer of the dart of craving, the Buddha is unrivaled. I bow to the great hero, the Buddha, kinsman of the sun. Just as Brahma is worshipped by the gods, dear sir, today we shall worship you. Come, let us bow to you. You alone are the awakened. You are the teacher supreme. In the world with its gods, there is no one like you. And so very moving, devout words of devotion spoken by Sakka at the end there. And Sakka addressed the fairy Panchasika. Dear Panchasika, you are very helpful to me since you first charmed the Buddha. Right? After which I went to see him. I shall appoint you to your father's position. You shall be king of the fairies. And I give you Bahadda Suryavachasa, who you love so much. So I don't know what Prabhupada thinks about that. Anyway, fine. Okay, there was still an arranged marriage that was still going on among the gods in those days, for sure. Okay, then Sakka, touching the ground with his hand. Interesting little detail, right? You're touching the ground with his hand. We see the Buddha image with the Buddha doing the ground-touching mudra. I'm just trying to think. This might be the only time in the suttas where this is mentioned. I have to check. I think this is the only. This is probably that idea of touching the ground maybe comes from this passage. I can't think of it being elsewhere. Panina patavim paramasitva. And then he was inspired to exclaim three times, homage to that blessed one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. Homage to that blessed one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. Homage to that blessed one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. And while this discourse was being spoken, the stainless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in Sakka, the Lord of Gods. Everything that has a beginning has an end. And also for another 80,000 deities. It's kind of just tacked on at the end a little bit there. Okay. All right. 80,000. Okay, fine. Such are the questions that Sakka was invited to ask and which were answered by the Buddha. And that's why the name of this discussion is Sakka's Questions. Notice this is quite an unusual ending for this discourse. Right, there's a lot of unusual features here, but normally a discourse ends by saying that, you know, the monks will delight or whoever delights in that. But here is quite a different kind of ending. So, again, you know, many features that suggest that this particular discourse is in literary terms, you know, quite evolved and quite late compared to the bulk of the suttas. Normally, when we read the suttas, we're used to having quite a simple narrative context. Whereas in the Digha Nikaya and suttas like this, we have quite an involved narrative context. But also, you know, it's interesting. When we think about earliness and lateness of suttas, you know, don't think about it in terms of like necessarily good and bad and so on like that. These are different modes of expression and different ways of relating the Dhamma, right? And you can see that the narrative took, you know, quite a lot of liberties with, like, you know, the literary conceits and so on. You know, it's quite a flamboyant and creative literary context, right? But the actual teachings would be just bog standard teachings that you find in the suttas. There's nothing different from anything that you find elsewhere in the suttas there. Huh? And when it comes to that core and the heart of the teaching, the tradition was very, very conservative to keep those things right there. So the purpose of adding the more literary and flamboyant elements was not to change the teachings or anything like that, but it was to present the teachings in a kind of a new way, and in a way that might, you know, for whatever reason, engage people in with their imagination or through humour, through storytelling, and so on. And I think this is something which I think is we see around us today, right? I mean, we all do it. All of us who teach Dhamma do the same thing. I mean, I don't just sit in front of you and just, this is what it says in the suttas A, B, C, D, right? It would get very boring very quickly, yeah? So we try to liven it up, tell a few stories, crack a joke, and so on. But when we do that, we also bear in mind that there's a difference between telling you a story and actually preserving the Dhamma. Yeah? And so we make sure that we're very careful with that distinction. So it's the kind of distinction that we see in the suttas as well. Who was it that said about the ending of the sutta? Oh, yeah. All right, it's now clear. We answered that along the way. Okay, good. Good, excellent. So are there any other questions before we wrap up? Yeah, come on.
This is presented along the term that seems to be final, one or the other.
To be cultivated or not to be cultivated? Yeah.
Good, bad.
Yeah.
That's also a form of the moment.
Surely you see that we've talked about bad and good and then better. That's a scale right there, isn't it? Okay. Go on. But still, it is a good point, though. It's an interesting point, yeah? Cognitive behavioral therapy? Yes.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. And you know, within the, I mean, I think that the way that the world is, the way that we talk about the world, that there tends to be, you know, we tend to be conditioned through features of the world, right? So, you know, basic binaries like, say, night and day, right? I mean, that's an important one, right? You think of all of the symbolism and everything that comes there, but not just that, but also just practically how you live, right? Night and day, and male and female, and all of these kinds of things, which we take as binaries, which we use as concepts. But of course, the problem is when you really start to break it down, it's never quite that simple, right? I mean, there's not an actual, when do you say night finishes and day begins? You know, it's actually a process, and it's ambiguous. Same thing with male and female, right? I mean, in many cases it's straightforward, but then there's trans people, and there's all kinds of cause grey areas between one and the other. So the things we take as binaries are never absolute, you know, so they're just kind of conventions which have a certain use, but if we get too stuck in them, yeah, then it can be problematic. It's interesting in the Theravada, one of the controversies in the Abhidhamma period, so a period say 200 years after the Buddha, okay, people wanted to classify the Buddha's teachings, so classify all the Dhammas of the Buddha's teachings. And there was a discussion or a controversy about whether they should be classified, all whether you could classify all the teachings as binaries, right? Say good and bad, and so on, right? And in the Theravadin tradition, in the Dhammasangani, it classifies some things as binaries and some things as triples. Yeah, which is actually very interesting. And the triple classification is actually more prominent. Yeah? And the fundamental triple quality, the first one and most important one in all of the Abhidhamma, Kusala Dhamma, which it talks about here, skillful, Akusala Dhamma, unskillful, Abhyakata Dhamma. Yeah? Abhyakata, literally undeclared. Yeah? And that's really crucial because that breaks down exactly that tendency to binary which you're talking about there. Yeah? So it's an acknowledgement that there are things that are undeclared. And undeclared things might be a glass. Is that good or bad? Well, I don't know. It's just a glass, right? It's okay. Right? But it also might be something very profound, like, say, Nibbana. Right? In one sense, Nibbana is good, but in another sense, it's beyond good and bad. Right? So that's acknowledged within the tradition that third category is useful and is helpful to break down that binary. Yeah. Right. 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 Not get too caught up in it, right? It's that whole thing that, you know, you learn through mindfulness, right? To be able to step back, to observe your feeling, not to ignore them or repress them, but to be able to understand that, where does this lead? Yeah? Not easy to do, right? It's easy to say, you just see, does this lead to skillful or unskillful, but quite a process to observe it and to understand. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right. It's one kind of binary. Yeah. Okay. All right, yeah. 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 Right. Maybe. Maybe, yeah. Yeah. They're setting him up for the future. Could be. Okay, we should probably wrap up about now. Do you want to make your announcement?